There are some cases where everything we've talked about won't work. This is the time to fire that person. Terminating an employee is the toughest task in management, and managers shrink from doing it. In fact, many almost refuse to do it. Managers resist firing people for some very good reasons, as well as some that aren't so good. First, let me say that you have to remember that managers typically have emerged at the top of their particular profession, proven themselves through long years of study or experience, and they like to do things right. They have a high need for achievement. The major reason why managers don't fire people is because they refuse to give up. They may be absolutely upset and unhappy at having to confront this person every day, and yet deep down, there is a dynamic operating that says, I cannot admit defeat with this person. In part, I think that dynamic is extremely helpful. Think of the people who were instrumental in your life. Others may have been inclined to give up on you, but they didn't. And because they didn't, because they stuck with you, they got a transformation. They got you on the right track. But there's a negative side to this picture, or at least the possibility of a negative, and that is that sometimes the high-achieving person isn't capable of recognizing that there are some things they cannot achieve. In some cases, the high achiever doesn't want to be seen as unable to handle all of the problems within his unit. To those perfectionists out there, let me offer this counsel. The most winning coaches in sports, the most effective executives in organizations, are those who know when it is time to cut a non-producer. While your own skills at turning people around may be substantial, there are some people you won't be successful with. To be a real winner in management means that you have to have enough objectivity to realize you are going to win some and lose some. The work of your profession, the mission of your organization, is too great and too important to be sacrificed to a stubborn resistance to take action when it is clearly called for. Another major reason why managers don't fire people comes out of their own anxiety and uncertainty about how to do it. The reality is that this is an infrequently performed function. The skills that are required to do it are not those that are used every day, and so there is some performance anxiety. There is also some anxiety about legal hassles that might arise, or the specter of things that possibly could go wrong and later haunt the manager in court. Another major reason why managers don't fire people is a humanistic concern of what will happen to this person. No one deliberately wants to hurt another, and the idea that the job requires managers to make termination judgments means that they are going to introduce pain and difficulty into the employee's life. Managers facing this situation will talk about the other person's family, their children, their mortgage, and so on. To managers who have difficulty in firing, I offer Sherman's Law. Fire people so that they can be successful someplace else. While that strikes some people as an astonishing statement, think about what is happening to people who are in jeopardy of termination. They know they're not performing well. They know they're not meeting expectations. Every morning as they get up, they know they're getting up to go to a job where their boss has largely rejected them. They may be facing a work group that is alienated from them, and they know they're going to have to go back into a losing situation. Day after day, as they pull into the parking lot, the knot in their stomach tightens. The managers of such employees are perpetuating a losing situation. In the name of compassion, these managers are inflicting emotional trauma and continued stress. Turnover studies show that people who leave the organization voluntarily are generally people who have high levels of confidence, positive self-esteem, and a real belief in their own capabilities. The low-talent, low-confidence people are those who tend to not go out the door of their own volition. They are insecure and they'll hang on in bad situations because they don't believe that they can do better somewhere else. They need help getting to the decision point that sends them through the door into the next phase of their life. Nobody who is terminated is overjoyed. Yet, if you talk to these people again 1 year after termination, about 80% of them will say that the termination was the best thing that ever happened to me. As unbelievable as it may sound, these people are now better and better off for the experience. Why is that? At the point of termination, people's whole lives are turned upside down. They have to start thinking about finding a job and what it is they want in life. They start looking in the want ads and going on interviews. And they come home at night and talk over each job with family and friends advising them. What tends to happen is that these people move from a point of maladjustment in their lives, where their jobs were not the right ones, to a point in life where they have different kinds of jobs, doing things they always wanted to do but were afraid to try. Remember, fire people so that they can be successful someplace else. So termination can simply be an opportunity to help a person, as well as solving a whole range of company problems that have been spinning out of the situation. None of us can guarantee the happiness or the success of any other human being. We can't do it for our own children. We can't do it for ourselves. We certainly can't do it for anyone who works for us. What we can do is help them be successful someplace else. The conversation might sound something like this.
As a manager, it's my job to help employees achieve their maximum performance levels, but I haven't been able to do that with you. I respect you enough to admit when I can no longer help you, and I've reached that point. Perhaps a manager at another firm will be better able to work with you. I don't see the point in perpetuating this unhappy working relationship. Since you haven't made the decision to move on, I feel obliged to make it for you. I wish you well in your future endeavors.
To that end, let's look at the termination procedure. 7 points make up the actual process of working a person through a termination. This will provide a framework and a feel for how to deal with this procedure. Most managers are far more comfortable with termination if it's structured and spelled out.
Number one, do it yourself, do it now, and don't pass the buck.
This is a job that cannot be delegated. It cannot be given to an assistant. There are all kinds of horror stories in American industry about managers who could not face the situation. Henry Ford I often could not face the situation, and employees would go to their office for work only to find their papers and belongings gone. They had to ask, "Where's my stuff?" This indirect way of telling people the facts of life is dehumanizing and demeaning. Henry Ford's firings were legendary. On one occasion, a manager came into work only to find the door to his office bricked up. On another occasion, a manager who didn't seem to be able to get these less subtle messages found himself moved into the office directly beneath Henry's own. A hole was chopped in his floor, thereby creating a hole in the ceiling of the man's office below. And through that hole, during the day, Henry Ford would toss his waste paper, literally using the other man's office as a wastebasket. Don't do those things to people. Give them the message and give it to them straight.
Number two, know your organization's policy constraints and internal procedures.
Every organization is a little different. Each has some policy requirements and personnel procedures, and these generally have been pretty well thought out. They represent the legal interpretation that your organization has received and include, perhaps, some of the simple mechanical and procedural things that will help this process move more smoothly. In some cases, I'll hear a manager complain, "Personnel won't let me fire somebody." Of course, that's usually not the case. Most personnel executives will not only let you fire somebody, they'll go out of their way to help you do it. But if a manager goes to personnel without documenting the case, without following the procedures, then personnel cannot support a decision to terminate, at least at that time. These constraints and procedures are there to protect the manager as he proceeds to excise this person from the organization. They're also there to protect the organization and its interests. And finally, and no less important, those policies are there to protect the employee. So all that's expected is due process and fairness and that things are done under a process of review. It's in doing things by the numbers at this point that you're going to avoid a lot of problems later on.
Number three, do this task in person.
Don't send a telegram saying, "Guess who is no longer wanted around here?" Don't send them a box of dead flowers. This is a job that has to be done in person. It can't be done over the phone. When it is done, it should be done in as short and sweet a way as you can make it. Get to the point. Don't waste a lot of time with small talk. The person probably already knows what's happening or may have a suspicion. Don't prolong the agony. Keep to the point. My recommendation is to view this as conversation that will take no longer than 15 minutes. There's simply no value in conducting an hour-long termination session.
Number four, preserve the dignity of the other human being.
You don't have to prove that this person is a terrible person in order to terminate them. You don't run by this person all the little petty things he has done or recite all of the negative failings in his character or performance. This is a time in which you ought to be using a great deal of tact and smoothness and skill in your interpersonal relating. This session is simply an announcement of a decision. Let me repeat that. This session is simply an announcement of a decision. It is not a discussion. In announcing your decision, keep in mind that the decision isn't subject to review nor intended for group participation. You've decided that this person will be leaving the organization. You are simply announcing it.
Tom, I think you know why we're here today. This hasn't been working out for a while, and we've discussed it several times before. I know you've tried to make it work, and I appreciate all the effort you've put in, but it just isn't working out. I've decided to call an end to this employment relationship. It's like the old story of the square peg and the round hole. Both are fine on their own, but they just don't fit together. That's the situation we have here. Tom, I want you to know that I harbor no ill feelings toward you. I have a lot of respect for you. This wasn't an easy decision to make. I know you'll find a better fit with another company, and you'll be successful in the future. I also know it may be rough for a while, and I wish you all the best. In the long run, Tom, I know this is the right thing for both of us. I have every confidence in you and your ability to succeed.
To some, that may sound a little hokey, but because the executive who used this approach was genuine in his relationships, the effect was positive. The words you use are less important than the sincerity and attitude behind them. The key in this conversation is to reaffirm personal worth to the departing employee by voicing positive expectations for his or her future and sending positive signals. It prevents the conversation from turning into a downer. A key point to remember is the supersensitivity of this moment. To show any tension or to attack the person is only going to create negative reactions. While you don't want to tell the employee he is wonderful in areas where he's failed to perform, there's nothing that prevents you from appreciating his value as a human being. I recommend that you try it. By all means, avoid going into any discussion of the reasons and justifications for why the person is being terminated. To go through all of your proofs at this late date will only lead to arguing and more unpleasantness. And to lay out all your evidence and reasons is to give to the employee your lawyer's brief. In a worst-case situation, where the employee decides to take his cause to court, you will simply give him an advance showing of your cards, a strategic error. Remember the objective. Carry out an announcement of a decision to terminate, and do that in as pleasant and face-saving a way as possible.
Number five, have all separation material in hand.
I've dealt personally with over 200 terminations, and it seems to me that the smoother you can make this process, the better. I really dislike moving the terminated person from place to place in the organization after the axe has already fallen. It always seems to be a lot smoother when the discussion can be handled totally in the manager's office. If the personnel executive normally conducts an additional separation interview, perhaps that could be conducted in the manager's office as well. Do whatever is possible in this closing period to make it as comfortable an experience as possible for the person being separated. To be paraded from office to office, to be overly visible to peers in the middle of this pain is to ask for an angry reaction. If separation checks are normally given on that day, have them already drawn along with any other materials used to explain what's going to happen with benefit plans. Collection of keys, manuals, or any other company property should all have been thought out in advance. In some cases, the manager might accompany the employee back to the locker room to assist in cleaning out the locker and taking him out of the building. A major corollary to this headline of making things as smooth as possible in the separation process is to be as creative and supportive in outplacement services as you can be. For example, many companies normally have a termination policy where 2 years of service entitles a terminated employee to only 2 weeks of termination pay. But with a little creativity, you may be able to more effectively implement that policy. Some organizations will give the separating employee some choices in this matter.
Tom, we can handle this either as a termination or as a voluntary resignation. If we handle it as a termination, I'll have to follow the policy manual and I'll only be able to give you 2 weeks of separation pay. But if you prefer, we could treat this as a voluntary resignation on your part. In that case, I'm empowered to continue your salary for a period of time longer than 2 weeks. In this particular case, for 6 weeks, while you physically wouldn't be at the company, and we would collect your keys and other company property today, your actual termination date would not be until 6 weeks from now. This will enable you to tell prospective employers that you're still working for us, which should be of help to you. Or I can increase the separation check to 6 weeks' worth of salary, payable today if you resign. So, Tom, we can handle this on a resignation basis if you prefer to go that route, or we can handle it as a regular termination. It's your choice.
In the event that the employee chooses to resign, have ready a brief resignation statement for them to sign. This will avoid any legal claim of wrongful firing. You have a statement of resignation on the record. Now, several things come out of that. One is that the employee who is savvy about job hunting processes will know he'll look better if he's resigned. And obviously, you've now made it better for him financially by going that route. Some managers worry about paying extra money to somebody who might not deserve it. I think the way to look at it is that it's cheap insurance, ensuring that you have done the very human thing of trying to help the person as he makes adjustments. And from a very practical standpoint, the route of voluntary resignation virtually eliminates future claims this person might care to make against the company. Some companies will go even further, paying for job hunting costs, resume writing services, and the like. I am generally in favor of anything that helps the person without compromising the company's legal position. Obviously, you may not want to do these extra things for serious offenses such as theft.
Number 6. Watch what is said to other people.
Employees will wonder what's happened. They'll be curious, and no doubt they will have heard some of the facts and rumors surrounding the case. The bottom line is that it's none of their business. Just because other employees knew the individual doesn't give them the right to know confidential information. The amateur in management may feel the need to justify his decision. This could lead to arguments or discussions with the remaining employees about the decision. Sometimes other employees will challenge the decision, voice their disapproval, thus prompting a defensive reaction. Management is not a popularity contest, and I don't think good management is served by defending these decisions to others. A simple announcement that Tom has decided to pursue other avenues in life, and possibly even expressing positive expectations that Tom is going to do well elsewhere, are sufficient. No purpose is served by discussing it further with other employees. There may be concern on the part of employees that Tom's departure may simply be a precursor of their own. If there are no other plans to take further termination action within the unit, then it wouldn't be out of line to put some word out that this is not part of a wholesale reduction in force. It's simply an individual decision that Tom made or that we made about Tom. So calm people's fears, but don't discuss the case. Watching what you say also applies to reference checks that will come in later about the former employee. In some organizations, all reference checks are handled by personnel, and this is the best practice. If you don't have this staff service available, the basic rule is, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. The safest course of action is to confirm dates of employment, job title held, and whether they're eligible for rehire. Because terminations always carry the risk of some future legal action, I wouldn't say anything else unless it's complimentary to the person.
Number 7. Analyze what went wrong.
That night as you go home, you'll be carrying a lighter load, but it will be a sober moment. An important arena of life, called work, has not panned out for someone that you were responsible for. You need to understand exactly what went wrong so you can learn from this experience. Were your selection processes inadequate? Did you get off track because of inadequate training? Were there poor supervisory role models for the employee to identify with? What can you learn? What are you going to do different next time? Managers who have used this 7-step approach have been successful with it. When you understand the underlying dynamics of why you naturally shrink from termination, you will reach a point of maturity that allows you to avoid dreading it. While you will never welcome this task, at least you can feel confident that what you are doing is right. Managers are always concerned about the feelings of the people they fire, but they're equally concerned about legal risks in a termination. We live in a society where people are more prone to take legal action than to negotiate. Increasingly, the courts have been handling cases which break down long-standing traditions in the law. Certainly, this has been so in a whole range of cases that surround the problem employee, and these have served to redefine traditional ways of looking at the workplace contract. It is beyond the scope of this program to be able to provide more than general advice on the legal implications of handling problem employees. What I will discuss here are general principles of the law that apply in the United States. While the law differs in other countries, the patterns and trends within all of North America have generally been moving toward protection of individual liberties. In case you are not dealing with a U.S. employment situation, you will need local legal counsel to advise you to the particular rules that will apply under your national statutes. While federal law applies anywhere in the United States and its territories, there is a patchwork quilt of state and local law that also apply. State and local statutes don't contradict or take precedence over national law, but in many cases they extend beyond federal law. In addition, there are also regulations that apply to certain industries, to military contractors and the like. This is why local legal counsel needs to go beyond the points of federal law that I will cover in this program. Since the law is continually being refined, either by legislators or the courts, you need your own legal counsel to assure that your company's rights, as well as those of the employee, are protected in a disciplinary or termination situation. Notwithstanding the variances that may apply to a particular case, the general principles covering the treatment of problem employee cases stem from a very old concept in the law known as employment at will. Employment at will means that since employees exchange their services in return for compensation, they are employed at the will of the employer. This means that the employer can initiate an action that will either discipline or discharge an employee for any reason. Let me state that again. An employer can discipline or discharge an employee anytime for any reason, good, bad, or indifferent, as long as it is not a specifically excluded reason. While that is the general meaning of the concept of employment at will, there are two major exceptions to the rule. The first exception is employees who are under an existing contract, whether a union contract or an individual employment contract. Discipline or discharges will have to be done according to the terms of that contract. The second exclusion to the general rule of employment at will is that the reason for disciplining or discharging cannot be imposed for a reason that has been previously prohibited by the law. Prohibited reasons, as spelled out in federal law, are not difficult for employers to deal with, since they are basically irrelevant to job performance. The prohibited reasons are age, sex, race, color, national origin, marital status, sexual preference, religion or creed, and finally, union activity or political belief. The employment at will doctrine does not allow an employer to discipline or discharge because of any of these factors. Managers who are trying to deal with a problem employee are often overly intimidated by these legal constraints. The fact is that the courts have not rejected the concept of employment at will. It's just that they require fair limits. Let's talk about due process restrictions. There are some additional areas beyond the protected categories of age, race, and the others where employment at will is restricted. The courts have also ruled that an employer may not discipline or discharge an employee who is involved in a due process action. For example, an employee who may have filed a complaint with the wage and hour people, either state or federal, must be allowed to pursue that question with the regulatory agency until a determination is made. Depending on the determination, an employer may then be able to discharge. In like fashion, employees who complain to a safety regulatory agency, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or its state-related agency, or the National Labor Relations Board, are in essence raising questions about fairness or appropriateness of treatment at work. Until these regulatory agencies have made a determination, an employer may not interfere, even though the employee may not have a just cause. Even though a complaint to the agency may be simply a delaying or annoying tactic, it still places the employee under the protection of due process. The concept of due process is implicit in both common law and the U.S. Constitution. The courts, in upholding it, are basically saying to any employer, give the employee an opportunity to raise his question. From the court's point of view, it's unknown whether the employee is right or wrong, and so the fairest thing is to hear the complaint, investigate the complaint, take time to understand the complaint, and then make a determination. This stepwise procedure through the regulatory agencies is a quasi-judicial approach which the courts look upon favorably. Key point: when an employer follows the due process principle in its own grievance procedures and in its own employee processing, that will also be looked upon by the courts in a favorable way. So a strategy that has to be pursued by any corporation trying to remove problem people is to let them follow the due process road. When those approaches have finally been exhausted, the firm can then remove the employees, assuming there is sufficient cause. Another restriction is unjust firings. Some firings go beyond the prohibited reasons for not firing employees and beyond the concept of not retaliating against those involved in due process. These are labeled unjust firings. The state-by-state differences of law or judiciary findings basically have held that terminating employees under some circumstances will not be allowed. Specific examples of this include what has been referred to as wrongful discharge. In one case, an employee was pressured by his employer to lie in court in a case involving the company. The employee refused and was later terminated by his employer. The court called that a wrongful discharge. A second example of unjust firing was a firing characterized as slander by the court. In a written reference check statement that was made about the employee, certain negative comments were made which the employer couldn't prove in court. The court found that to be unjust. A third example of an unjust firing was what one court ruled the intentional infliction of emotional abuse. In this particular case, the employee was badgered into resigning. The work environment was made extremely unpleasant, and the person was not treated with any sense of dignity or respect. In this instance, the court ruled that an employer's right to discharge does not give them the right to emotionally abuse the person. In another case, words used in an employment policy were held to be the basis for an unjust firing. The employer manual stated that when an employee finished his probationary period, that he would then become a permanent employee. A so-called permanent employee was later fired and presented the case to the court. The court indicated that if you're going to call a person a permanent employee, that doesn't mean the employee suddenly loses that permanence because you want to fire him. The courts have also ruled firing is unjust if there is an implied contract. Earlier I said employees who are under a union contract or individual employment contract will find their relationship with the employee governed by that contract. This limitation on employment at will was extended by one court in which the jurist ruled that there is an implied contract and that statements from the supervisor or the employee manual can be considered as binding as a written contract. In perhaps one of the most chilling and questionable decisions handed down by a jurist, a firing was held to be unjust if the reason for firing was unfair or unreasonable. When it comes to what is unfair and unreasonable, I think that you can readily see that such conditions are often largely in the eyes of the beholder, which throws a real wild card into the workplace. While the wording of the decision may have been unfortunate, the court was again reminding the employer that it likes things done in a nice, neat, and orderly fashion. The court likes due process and some fairness in the exercise of employment at will. One last example of this increasingly difficult thicket of legal rulings is that it's been held unjust for the employer to deal negligently with the employee. It has been considered management negligence not to tell an employee what to do. And if the employee in court says to the judge, "If I'd been told what it was they wanted me to do better, I would have done it better," the court may rule management negligence as the reason why this employee has not performed. If the employer can't prove that a reasonable effort was made to show the employee what to do, the case may be impossible to win. While this is almost a catch-22 situation, it does say that for the employment at will doctrine to prevail, the employer must in fact have shown some effort to turn the person around before exercising the authority to fire. So what's the bottom line? Having said all of this, and perhaps having scared you half to death in doing so, let me emphatically draw this conclusion. If you have someone who is worth terminating or who needs to be disciplined in some other fashion, do not be intimidated by these legal controls. Your first responsibility is to the corporation, to whatever action is appropriate in your situation. It's on that basis that you must make your decisions. Never be afraid and never refrain from taking corrective action. Move ahead, but move ahead deliberately in a stepwise fashion, following your procedure and policy. Remain in line with your state statutes and federal law and never overstep or violate due process. There are other steps you can take to avoid getting caught in a bad situation. One would be to remove language from correspondence and letters implying a promise of continued employment. The concept that everyone is always, in a sense, on probation should be expressed in correspondence and personnel manuals. A second suggestion, in order to keep your options open, is to refer to your probationary period as an introductory period or a beginning period with the employer. This gets rid of the question of am I or am I not on probation. A third specific recommendation is to deal consistently with all employees. In this way, variances in practice can't be misconstrued. A common problem is that different managers will have different interpretation of policy. When interpretations vary too widely, you have no policy. The courts may rule that the actual practice is policy, even if that practice is completely different from what's in the policy books. Beyond these administrative concerns, you may want to go back and listen to the other tapes in this series that talk about the positive prevention of employee problems and the positive discipline practices that should apply once problems begin to surface. They incorporate the documentation, feedback mechanisms, assessment procedures, and the like that will form the basis of an excellent legal case. Now let's consider some key legal questions to make sure you're on track. First, did you deal fairly with the employee? To deal fairly obviously means that there has been no discrimination against people in the protected categories. Dealing fairly also means that there's been some honest effort to help the person overcome his difficulty. A second key question to ask to make sure you're on safe ground, has your process been objective? Have ratings been given? Feedback provided? Have there been training programs? Have disciplinary warnings been put in writing? Is there some evidence to support the claim of poor performance? Where the employer has been as objective as it's possible to be under sometimes emotional circumstances, that looks good, and courts view it in a favorable manner. And a third major legal concern, is there evidence of consistency? Is there any reason to believe that you have treated this particular case differently than you've treated other cases? For instance, have other chronic latecomers been retained while this particular employee has been fired? Have certain classes of jobs or certain departments been given preferential treatment? In conclusion, what it all comes down to is that where you can show the court you have been fair, objective, and consistent, there is a very good reason to believe you will win any case that may be brought against you. Again, I say, go back and look at the positive prevention procedures previously outlined, along with those for positive discipline, because they have built into them those aspects for fairness, objectivity, and consistency that the courts are looking for. And I think that not only will you satisfy the courts, but you'll satisfy yourself. You'll know that you've done your job right. You'll have no reason to apologize or feel bad about the decisions that you've made. In the final analysis, we all have to satisfy our own internal judge and answer to the court of self-respect. The procedures that have been outlined in this program will allow you to give an affirmative answer in that court and all others. They will also help you avoid court action in the first place by developing your employees along with your business for mutual growth and prosperity. From losers to winners, your challenge is a marvelous opportunity. You are where you are because you are a winner. And if you can help those needing to change from losing to winning, you'll be one of the great ones in American leadership.
You've heard Managing the Problem Employee with Dr. Clay Sherman. Using the strategies presented here, you're on your way to turning losers into winners. You'll find that you'll want to listen to this program several times to make sure you've fully assimilated all of Dr. Sherman's ideas. As with every Nightingale Kona tape, you'll find new information with each listening. Remember, management is getting things done through other people. To be successful, you've got to understand and communicate with all different types of people in all different kinds of situations in both your professional and personal lives. We'd like to bring you an excerpt from another Nightingale Conant program that will help you do just that. It's called Relationship Strategies, and it's by Jim Cathcart and Tony Alessandra.
To understand how to deal with people appropriately, there are two major areas of difference to watch: openness and directness. Both of these are external behaviors. In other words, they are things people do. That's one of the unique factors of relationship strategies. We focus on the observable behaviors and the observable differences in people. Let's look at open behaviors. Now, open people are self-disclosing, show and share their personal feelings freely, emphasize the main ideas, make decisions based on feelings. In other words, they tend to be rather subjective. Open people have animated facial expressions during speaking and listening. You can read them like a book, as some people say. They show outwardly much more enthusiasm than the other people would. Their handshake will be friendly and warm. They will be likely to give you nonverbal feedback. For example, you can look at them and you can tell by the expression on their face or the way they move how they're reacting to your ideas. Listen to these descriptions of self-contained behavior. Self-contained people tend to be rather guarded. They tend to keep their feelings private, and they share information about themselves only on a need-to-know basis. They are very fact-oriented, and in business or unfamiliar social situations, they take some time to get to know. They're primarily task-oriented, whereas an open person is more relationship-oriented. They are disciplined about how their time is used by others because they stick to a schedule rather strictly. They prefer following an established schedule, and they have fixed expectations about people and situations. They prefer to work independently. They avoid or at least minimize physical contact. They're not touchers as a rule. Let me give you a further example of the difference between openness and self-contained behavior. This comes from my own family background. When I first met my mother-in-law and father-in-law, it was in 1970. My wife, Paula, took me to their house, and we walked in the front door, and she said, "Jim, I'd like you to meet my mother and my father." Her mother was closest to us, and Paula said, "Mom, this is Jim Cathcart." As I turned to shake her hand and greet her, she gave me a double-handed handshake. Taking my hand warmly between both of hers, she looked me square in the eye and said, "Hello, Jim. It's good to see you." She started asking about my background, about my family, and we took a few moments to get to know each other. I felt very welcome, very warm, very much accepted by her. Then we looked across the room to Paula's father, and she said, "Dad, this is Jim Cathcart." I turned to him and said, "Hello, how are you?" In return, he nodded. That was his acknowledgement. You see, Paula's mother was very open, her father very self-contained. His limited response seemed an appropriate response to him, but to me it seemed a lot less than I would have desired, because I wanted more communication from him. Therein lies one of the problems with openness and self-contained behavior. When one person is open and another is self-contained, if one of them doesn't adjust to the other person's style, at least temporarily, then tension arises between the two of them.
For more information on relationship strategies and to receive a free catalog with information on other Nightingale Conant programs, please call us toll-free at 1-800-323-5552. Thanks for listening, and come hear us again soon.